Oh hey, didn't see you there. Welcome to Secondary Fermentation, episode number 86. I'm here with Stevie Nicks.
And Bill Hicks. I don't know if many people know who Bill Hicks is.
Bill Hicks, it sounds familiar.
He's a comedian, or he was a comedian. I think he passed away pretty young.
Let's see this guy.
My dad really liked him. He was very... he would have been canceled in today's comedy scene, probably.
That guy.
He was pretty dirty with his comedy, but he always like smoked on stage, and he wasn't alone in that regard, but yeah, he always had some pretty inappropriate jokes.
Died at the age of 33.
Wow. He was way younger than I thought, but yeah.
Actually, didn't even make it. He was 32.
What did he die from? Was it overdose or something, or like...
Died from
heart attack,
telling jokes too hard.
Told one too many.
Pancreatic cancer
at 33. Mm-hmm. That's terrible.
Spread to his liver.
Wow.
He still toured and recorded an album.
Yeah. Well, Stevie Nicks probably more well known than Bill Hicks. I couldn't rhyme with six. I was having trouble. Six sticks.
Yeah.
Oh, I could have said. The band Styx.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, anyway.
Well, you got till 96. You can do it again.
Yeah, as if I'll remember.
Yeah. Yeah, we're here with Nick, and this is Joe, and we're back for another episode. Lauren's out of here. She's kind of like a guest at this point. Transitioned off, and we're just here, two dudes with two microphones.
And two glasses.
One love. For beer.
But oh, yeah, beer, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
I was all going to say that, too.
Why were you reaching your hand out towards me, Nick? But we're here. We're ready for another episode. But what's going on in the beer news?
Beer news.
I think we need a little theme song or something to play there. Sounds very newsy.
I know, yeah. We need to get a little sound bite or something to throw in there. Maybe mm-hmm. I'll play around with that. But, it was just International Beer Day, so happy belated to those who celebrate.
International Beer Day.
August 2nd.
IBD. Inflammatory bowel disease. Love it.
Love IBD. But yeah, so a lot of talk about beer and, kind of updates with, beer destinations, of course, and as far as the U.S. goes, there was an article put out from tastingtable.com where they did a sort of a scoring of a few different metrics to determine what are the top U.S. cities for beer enthusiasts for 2024.
And it said, shocking. And then it said, breweries hate him.
Breweries hate this article. One
this one city.
They hate this one city.
Yeah. But yeah, Tasting Table put together a nice little... table of
nice table as they do
of cities that have the best cities for beer lovers, and the criteria they used were breweries per 10,000 people, bars per 10,000, number of beer tasting tours, and the average beer price to give a total score out of 100. Nobody scored a 100.
Yeah, nobody even got an A.
No one got an A, even this top city, which is one we visited mm-hmm. several times, right in our own backyard.
Right in our own... It's Joe's backyard.
It's my backyard. It's a city.
Come on out. It's the best spot in the country.
Yeah. But we're talking about, of course, Asheville, North Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
Western part of the state, about, would you say, 5 hours from us almost?
Yeah, about five, yeah.
But it's worth every minute.
It is, yeah. And... honestly, if they weren't number one, I probably would just totally discredit this list entirely, but I'm a little biased. But I think, no, it's a really good, even by metrics, I think it's clearly the number one choice, but I think even if you go outside of these metrics, you could just say subjectively that it's one of the best. But yeah, they actually have four breweries per 10,000 people. They've got 16.52 bars per 10,000 people. They have a total of 9 beer tasting tours available if you visit. And this was the shocking part. The beer price on average is $4.
Which, I don't know where they're paying $4 for
beer. I know.
Beer. I don't ever remember.
Where is this mystery $4 beer?
Give me your $4 beer. And that's the, if that's the average, like.
There's some lower.
There's like, yeah, dollar beer nights or something.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe there's a lot of specials or something. Well, I guess.
And if you're talking about just bars, I mean, we usually just go to breweries when they're out there. So I can't say that we really have gone to bars and bought like a Bud Light or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that could be where it draws down that total. But gave him a score 80 out of 100. That was the top score. So a lot of other surprises on this list, though. I guess including the bars kind of makes it, you know, in my mind, it sort of changes the list that I would think of, just because it includes things like really heavy beer cities like Pensacola, Florida, apparently, which has 23.45 bars per 10,000 people.
Oh, man.
That's a lot of bars. They actually do have, 2.42 breweries per 10,000. So, still pretty high in the brewery department, but definitely inflated by their number of bars.
Yeah.
And they only have one beer tasting tour available.
Oh, no.
All those breweries, so.
All 2.42 of them. Well, 2.42 per 10,000.
Per 10,000. Yeah, the average price there was only $4.50, so not bad for Florida.
You know, Las Vegas, number three. I wouldn't really think of Las Vegas as a beer city. No. And I don't think really Las Vegas thinks of Las Vegas as a beer city. Surprisingly, less bars per 10,000 people than Pensacola. But 15.93 bars per people, but only 0.33 breweries per 10,000 people.
But 15 beer tasting tours. That is pretty crazy.
Hopefully those bars have capacity for 30,000.
Yeah. The only part... The only part I don't believe about that metric is their beer price at apparently $5 average beer price.
That must count all the free ones you get while gambling. Yeah,
there's got to be some free ones in there because Vegas drinks are notoriously pricey. But
Greenville did make the list at number five.
Yeah, Greenville.
The wrong Greenville. Greenville, South Carolina.
Yeah.
Well,
I guess we have probably like 0.1 brewery per 10,000 here. So.
Yeah, exactly.
But
what would we have? Population of roughly 100,000. We've got three breweries.
So
not good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe next year. I'm surprised like Charlotte's not on here, but
we're about Las Vegas standards as far as the number of breweries per people.
About three. Yeah.
I guess unless you count like Duck Rabbit or something or Wilson or. But then we're kind of cheating.
Then we're adding a lot more population. And, I guess then, if you just base it on like a certain radius of Greenville. But
anyway, Greenville, North Carolina didn't make it on the list.
Not cutting it.
It's interesting. Check it out.
Portland, Maine. I know people talk about the two Portlands. There's obviously Portland, Oregon, and Portland, Maine are kind of both viewed as some of the meccas in the United States for craft beer enthusiasts. So they came in at four, just ahead of Greenville, South Carolina. They've got actually, I think, the highest average cost of beer at $7 out of this list of 15. So
how did Portland, Maine beat Portland, Oregon?
I don't know. Yeah.
I feel like if you're thinking of like Pacific Northwest, that's where you think of with beer.
They are pretty dense, I guess. Like they're the second highest average number of breweries per capita. So they come in just under Asheville at 3.91. A decent number of bars, same amount of beer tasting tours as Asheville, but it's the price of the beer, I think, that really brings them down. If they had cheaper average cost of beer, they probably would be top two. It looks like they're very similar to Asheville, but it's that really sneaky, pricey beer. So Greenville at five, you talked about. Lancaster, Pennsylvania at six. I know nothing about that. And then Pittsburgh at seven, so two Pennsylvania spots right there at six and seven, both pretty similar metrics, and their final scores were 55 and 53 respectively. So
I feel like this list is kind of skewed a little bit. I mean, I know they make it per 10,000 people, but if you look at like Portland, Maine versus Portland, Oregon, just did a quick population check.
Yeah.
Portland, Oregon is literally 10 times the size of Portland, Maine.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, you wouldn't really expect like a proportional increase in the number of breweries. You know, I feel like that would be
Yeah.
weird. if it everything scaled so appropriately like that.
It yeah, and I guess like one benefit to Portland, Maine would be, you know, if it's a little more dense with breweries versus Portland, Oregon has a lot of great breweries and it's, you know, obviously a larger city. So perhaps if you're looking for just a smaller city to visit that has most bang for your buck without having to drive all over.
Yeah.
You know, that might be of some kind of importance to you in planning your trip. But yeah, definitely, you know, the metrics here are what they are. And so,
yeah,
kind of interesting how it, you know, lands on this scoring table. But we've got Cincinnati, Ohio at number 8, New Orleans at number 9 with a whopping 0.49 breweries per 10,000 people.
Yeah.
At a decent number of bars and tasting tours. Not a bad price. Average price of beer at $5.10. So
yeah,
kind of impressed by that lower cost. I would think of New Orleans to be a pricey city, but then we mentioned Portland, Oregon. They're at 10. So
yeah,
kind of, yeah, definitely farther down on the list than I would have expected.
And there's some big beer cities, I think, on here, like Denver, Colorado's next at 11. Mm-hmm. Who could forget Harrisburg, Pennsylvania?
Man, we got number Pennsylvania, apparently.
Number 12. You know what's funny? As we go through Harrisburg, when we drive back to my parents' house, and I never think of it. It's like,
well, now you can.
I think we did stop at a brewery one time there, but I don't know.
Or you could stop at one of their many bars, because they have 17.2 bars per 10,000 people.
Per 10,000 people.
And zero tasting tours. How'd they make the list?
I would expect Pennsylvania's bar number to be higher, just because like their liquor laws are so weird.
Oh.
Like you can't buy beer but at certain places and this and that. So yeah.
It's a gold bar.
Yeah. Rochester, New York, number 13. Interesting. I've been there a few times, but I never think of it as like Beer City, New York. I thought there'd be some other places in New York.
Yeah. Well, even and then 14 on the list, St. Louis, Missouri. I was like, you know, I've not really been to St. Louis, but I've not known them to be, you know, super heavy in the craft beer scene. But maybe they have, looks like they have a ton of bars. Interestingly, I think of like Kansas City, Missouri to be more of a place for a beer enthusiast to plan on their road trip. But I don't know. I guess they have a high number of bars and a few tasting tours there.
Doesn't St. Louis have Budweiser?
Yeah, it could be. That's probably part of it. Is
big there. Yeah.
But and then,
rounding up the list.
Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas. Yeah. They have a lot of tasting tours. 15. I was tied for most with Vegas. And not a high number of bars or breweries. So, I don't know. It's just got to be the tasting tours that really
bumped
gets
it
the
up.
Score to round out the top 15.
Yeah.
So,
bit
of a shock.
That's the list. They also have little blurbs about each city as well if you want to check it out. We can probably include the link in our, well, somewhere.
Yeah, we'll put a link somewhere.
We'll put a link somewhere. You can check it out.
Check it out, but
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go to one of those cities. Do it.
Do it.
Do it.
Go. Click it.
Yeah. You know, talking about all these breweries and beers and bars makes me want to crack a beer.
Makes me want to crack a beer. Wow, what are these? We got some interesting beers to crack here.
Crack.
Should I crack this beer and see what it sounds like?
Crack it. Ooh.
No, my tummy's not upset. That was the
Nick,
beer.
Nick, are you okay? But yes, beautiful crack of a beer. We'll leave you in suspense for a moment while Nick pours to guess what he just cracked. Oh, that was quite a ASMR type pour. All right, Nick, the suspense is killing me. What did you just pour into that glass?
Well, if your ears know a nitro beer, then you would have heard that's what it indeed was. So it was not a Guinness, but it was actually one of the first craft beer iterations of a nitro stout, and that's the Milk Stout Nitro from Left Hand Brewing Company. I feel like Left Hand Brewing Company.
Gee, Illikers, that's good.
Yeah, Joe's over there reveling in the Milk Stout. I haven't had a Nitro Milk Stout from them in a while, actually.
No, it's been a minute. I think that's why I was, you know, gee willikering, because it's pretty tasty.
Golly,
it's
this good. Beer sure is nice.
Well, geez, mister. Well, Paul. For some reason, we've been watching Andy Griffith's show again. And it's just like, well, like Lauren one night was like, let's watch something wholesome. I was like, oh, there's Andy Griffith on Peacock. And so we started watching it. And I'm like,
never actually seen that show.
Oh, it's pretty. It's a classic.
Classic.
Mm-hmm. It's just such like silly, wholesome.
Wholesome humor.
It's usually like, yeah, Andy doing something, getting himself into some trouble. Andy. And then them being like, then him realizing his shortcomings and going and fixing everything.
Oh, that sounds good.
But
sounds like you learn a lesson, mm-hmm, at the end. But yeah, so, you know, typical appearance of a nice nitro. You've got that really tight, creamy looking foam. On this one, you know, of course, it's a milk stout, so it's a really dark beer at baseline. And then you've got just a nice, mm-hmm, tan, creamy head there. And it's obviously the cascading effect is dissipated by now, but if you've ever had a freshly poured nitro, you know that rippling cascade effect, yeah, in the beer, which is just oh so nice to see.
And I've already drank down quite a bit of mine, and it looks now like a shot of espresso in a glass.
It does. I mean, look, the ratio of your crema foam to beer is like 1-to-1 right now.
It really is.
It really retains nicely.
Yeah. Laces which is one of the nice, glass beautifully.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that nice lace on there. But, yeah, you know, shout out to Jen, who I was talking to her recently, and I was like, you know, I'm kind of having some, like, I guess writer's block or creative block with, like, you know, what's left to talk about with craft beer these days? And, you know, we had an episode on carbonation a while back, especially with the CO2 shortages. We kind of took a little bit of a detour to different avenues that you could, that breweries could use if they were short on CO2, because it really affected a lot of the microbreweries, yeah, that were not able to get CO2 readily. One of the options, of course, is nitro, but, you know, I thought there's a lot more to talk about. We could kind of make it its own, mm-hmm, topic. And,
yeah,
you know, starting with kind of just, you know, what is nitro and why is it in beer? And if you've ever, you know, had a nitro beer, you've probably had it as a Guinness, which, you know, is not without merit, because Guinness was really the first brewery that introduced nitro to beer as like a commercial product and, mm-hmm, a regular offering. You know, for years we had really only one source of carbonation, and that was CO2. And, you know, of course, initially it was just naturally produced through, you know, kind of the conditioning process when people would cask beer, and there'd be a little bit of conditioning and fermentation. So you get that natural CO2. Now, of course, we can kind of force carbonate with CO2 as a gas in a cylinder, and you just kind of, you know, either like Joe making his homebrew recently, mm-hmm, just doing a little bit of forced carbonation and get those.
I only use CO. I like to use carbon monoxide.
Carbon monoxide.
I feel funny.
Don't drink Joe's homebrew. Actually, I wonder if you drank CO or carbon monoxide, like what would happen?
I'm curious if it would enter your bloodstream. Yeah. I don't know how like volatile it is, if it would just shoot out of the beer or what.
Maybe you'd be less burpy. I don't know.
Maybe it just would displace all the oxygen off your hemoglobin and die.
I'm not willing to try. I'm not willing to find out. Just something to think about.
Yeah. But yeah, like you said, Guinness kind of came up with the commercial example. And as you said before, cask ale was the big thing. And cask ale, they used, if you've had it recently, there's some places that still, you know, have it. It's kind of not a common thing, more of a rarity, but they use these hand engines that they actually like physically pump the beer out, mm-hmm, manually, yeah, versus every other system today is going to use some sort of pressurized gas to push the beer out of the keg and into your glass. And they were doing things like, you know, not figuring out ways to get the beer and have it be carbonated at the breweries. So they would send things like unfinished beer, and there'd be like a cellar master at the bar that would finish the beer, which is probably a nightmare for brewers. But then they're like, well, we got this liquid nitrogen, let's try that. And that they did.
And now we know the rest is history. But yeah, I mean, at the time it was definitely a big jump from the former carbonation that people were used to with beer. You know, as we know, CO2 has its own distinct kind of mouthfeel when you enjoy beer that's really crisp and kind of lifts, you know, the flavors, and they kind of, you know, they're kind of prickly on your tongue. And so, you know, your beer, your soda, anything that's like a sparkling beverage, you just get that iconic mouthfeel.
Crisp.
But you go a totally different direction with nitro. When you have a nitrogenated beer, it is super soft, velvety, smooth, milky, creamy, whatever adjective you want to use. It's just a totally different palatable experience. And so with that comes some challenges, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, pairing beers. And so a lot of times you really only see like dark, roasty, malty beers. You know, stouts are kind of probably the leading beer still for nitrogenated beers across mm-hmm. the world. But, you know, people have started to experiment a little bit. And Left Hand Brewing Company, you know, they're kind of one of the first to really, I guess, push the envelope in the United States. And they have a lot of new history in their operation as far as like what they've contributed to the United States and just craft brewing as a kind of a leading purveyor of nitro.
Yeah. And, you know, think of stouts, but they've done other things. You know, they got the Flamingo Dreams, which mm-hmm. is a classic. I've had coffee blonde ales that are nitro. Some golden stouts too. But what is that one?
They got that one blonde stout, but it's the white Russian.
Yeah.
Golden stout. Then they have like that one like Tiki Dreams, I think. Oh. It's like a pineapple wheat beer, I think, or something like that.
Yeah.
So, another one here is the Belgian White. It's a Belgian style wheat beer nitro.
Ooh.
So, you know, again, like malty, maybe sweet, you know, roasty. Those are all things that work well with the nitrogenated beer. You really want something that's, you know, going to be complemented by having kind of a smoother, creamy mouthfeel. There are some flavors, though, that are really kind of elevated by having CO2. And CO2 is an ingredient in beer. Whether or not we think of it as like an inherent part of it, it really mm-hmm. is kind of vital to the success of a lot of beer. If you've ever had a flat beer, you know that it tastes totally different than something carbonated. And so certain styles like IPAs, really bitter or hoppy beers, they are, you know, really complemented by CO2. And so the absence of that and replacing that with nitrogen has been often met with like very little success. It basically is akin to like having an uncarbonated IPA or like
have a nitro hazy, please.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even like if you're homebrewing and if you're like pulling a little bit of your finished product to taste it before it's carbonated, it's going to taste different than when you finally get the carbonation introduced. And so, you know, that's why you don't really see those kind of hoppy bitter styles out there. Anything that's really a hop forward beer is not typically going to be introduced to nitro. And so, not that they haven't tried. The headmaster or the head brewer at
headmaster
Dumbledore
Hogwarts
Dumbledore at Left Hand. He's talked about, you know, they certainly have tried and they've just not been happy with the results from doing some of those styles. So. Yeah. But even still, they've got a wide portfolio, like all the ones we've mentioned mm-hmm. for nitro. So,
but yeah, all those flavors could complement nicely. But what do you say we crack open another one and do maybe a back-to-back tasting of can to bottle? We can talk a little bit about how nitro works.
Yeah. And so this one is the Milk Stout Nitro from Left Hand, but the bottle edition. So I've always wanted to kind of do this anyway, and so what better time than now? You know, we crack the can, but they offer it in both the can and bottle. And kind of going back to a little bit of Left Hand Brewing's history, they were the first, I think, in the United States and in craft beer to really perfect the science of getting a nitrogenated beer in the bottle without a widget, which we'll, you know, kind of talk about the widget here in a little bit. But it's a little, you know, plastic ball you find in your can of Guinness or other nitro beers, but they've bottled a nitrogenated beer without the device inside of it. And it's kind of like a trade secret. Like, people have figured out kind of the gist of what they're doing, but it's not something that, like, I Googled multiple different ways to find out, like, how are they able to keep it nitrogenated? Yeah. How do they keep that? Or how do they let the nitrogen kind of activate once the bottle's been opened? Because as we go into detail with the widget, there's a very vital role that device plays in sort of kickstarting the nucleation and getting that nitrogen to become that, like, bubbly, but like that thick kind of cascade-y, velvety beer. And so
you got to hire Slugworth to find out what it is. Got to get the secret for the everlasting nitro stopper.
Oh, we just watched Wonka on the plane the other day. That was interesting because they had Slugworth or Slughorn. What was his name? Slugworth?
I think
Slughorn was like Harry Potter. What am I on Harry Potter for? But anyway, so we're going to crack this bottle here. Heard a little bit of
gas. With the world's worst bottle opener.
Which is not bad. Nothing too different about this bottle than a normal beer bottle. But here's the fun part is on the bottle, and they have it upside down, there's instructions for how to pour this and release the nitro magic.
You know, that's kind of a bad play. I get they're trying to illustrate the point of it upside down, but, like, it's not like you're going to turn it upside down while you're pouring it and then read the instructions. Like, you want to read them right side up.
You need to be able to read it now.
Maybe it's to catch your eye.
It is. I think that's the point. Is it's kind of like, ooh, there's something on here I need to see. But what's interesting to me that I just noticed today, the instructions say, pour hard to release the nitro magic, and then later it says pour hard at 40 to 45 degrees Fahrenheit and then serve at 50 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit in a stout glass. But the part that's interesting, the pour hard instructions have that registered, like, trademark symbol. So I think they've actually
trademarked
pour hard as far as serving this nitro out of a bottle. And so, I mean, it's really not, I guess, that big of a shock considering that they mastered the art of keeping it nitrogenated while it's in the bottle without any kind of device in there. But so we're going to pour it and we're going to see if we get that same cascade look as we did from the can.
Beautiful. Nice hard pour.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. See that?
Oh, yeah. Beautiful. You know, I just love watching it where it just kind of waves along. It's like watching two liquids with different densities dancing in the glass. It even just pours like smooth sounding. Yeah, I mean, identical. I mean, it's the same beer. It's funny, the foam bubbles almost look a little bigger on these, like a little more. But it still has that, like, creamy, thick head.
Yeah. This will be interesting to see if right after the canned nitro, if we're able to tell any difference between can or bottle.
It smells a bit more roasty. A little more sweet coffee-like aroma. Slightly different flavor, yeah.
Slightly different flavor, and I do think there are some, like, slightly noticeable carbonation in here versus it being completely.
Yeah, it's not as silky smooth as the can was.
Yeah. And so there's been some speculation that there's, like, a nitro carbonation kind of mixture with the bottle version without, like, having the little nitro widget in there. And there's also speculation that right before they cap it, they add a little bit of that liquid nitrogen in there, cap it, and then it's, you know, it's insoluble nitrogen in beer, and so I guess that suspension there, as long as it's under pressure, is able to kind of maintain its state. And then when you release the cap, you don't hear that, like, hiss that you do, because there's no, like, explosion of gas release that there is with the widget in the can, but somehow it's able to give that same kind of presence. I don't know. It's a really weird process. I couldn't find out a lot about it.
Yeah.
But it is. I do feel like there's a little bit of, like, a sharp carbonation.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's subtle, but it's there. Whereas the other one was completely smooth.
Slightly more bitter too. I will say I like the can better. I think it's just, you know, it's just, it's more of a true nitro pour. Even like watching the glass, like this, the foam cascaded like halfway down, whereas the can, it was like all the way kind of. So, but yeah, so getting into nitrogen and Nick was explaining a little bit of how it works. But I mean, we come into contact with nitrogen all the time. You interact with it more than you think. I mean, being the most ubiquitous gas in the air that we breathe, about what, 70% of air is nitrogen. But what they do is they take it, they put it under a lot of pressure, compress it, and get it to go to a liquid state, cool it down. And that's the way they really have to kind of inject it into the beer, is under pressure and at cold temperatures. And that's why they have to come up with widgets and all these other things to maintain that pressure. And then also to disturb the gases again once you crack it open.
Yeah, and so talking about widgets, the original widget was, you know, produced by Guinness for their nitro beer, which makes sense because they were, again, like the pioneers of kind of commercializing nitro beer. So their cans have, you know, that kind of iconic little plastic widget tool that, you know, basically floats in the beer after they add a little bit of the liquid nitrogen right before sealing the can off. What it does is it kind of rests right below the surface, and it's got, you know, a couple small holes in there, so it allows some of the gas and beer to enter the inner chamber of that widget. And then when you pop the can, that sudden release of the pressure, it then releases the, it kind of disturbs all of the nitrogen in the beer. So when you pour it out, and they say you can drink it from the can, but the kind of preferred method is to pour it into a glass.
Mm-hmm.
You've kind of agitated all of the nitrogen within the beer because, you know, it's insoluble. And so it's kind of just like, I think they said it's like 100 times more insoluble in beer than carbon dioxide.
It's so interesting how it works for such a simple device. You know, you're just using the like equalization of the pressure with inside the can, which is much higher than the atmospheric pressure. So that insoluble liquid nitrogen, you know, equilibrates with the beer in the can and then the air in the widget and just chills in there. And then when you crack the can, the release of it, that hiss, is it slowly releasing through those small holes, like shooting out and then disturbing the nitrogen, releasing that pressure, causing the bubbles to cascade. It's so simple, but so complex at the same time. Yeah. It's very interesting. It's like, hey, let's put a ping pong ball with a couple holes in it in this, and it'll cause this crazy reaction.
Yeah. And I think we were talking about this just before we started recording today, but you know, before I read about the technology of the widget, I assumed that that widget was actually intact before you cracked the can open. And that
filled with nitrogen.
Yeah, and like that's what released the nitrogen into the beer. But the nitrogen's already present. It's just in suspension or in solution within the beer. And so it needs to be sort of awoken by that release of gas at a really rapid pace.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like, because that's what I thought too. I was like, oh, how does it crack it when you... It must be when you crack the can, it pops it open or something. But boy, was I wrong. It's just simple.
And to our knowledge, you know, that's pressure. Basically a similar phenomenon with the bottled version of these nitro beers where, you know, you really have to pour it hard to get that effect. Because if you pour it, like we kind of typically think of pouring a beer neatly, which, you know, you can argue is not the correct way either, to kind of pour a slow tilt down the side of the glass. If you were to do that with a nitro beer, you're not really going to get the same mouthfeel or effect visually as you would by doing that aggressive pour. And so, yeah, it's just all about kind of agitating the
It's really
the nitrogen that's already present in the beer when they you know, can or bottle it.
So it's either you do it hard and they've got a good balance of nitro, or you know, they kind of cram it in there and then the widget releases it.
Yeah. And I don't see a lot of people doing bottled nitrogen beer anyway. I think Left Hand was the first I saw. And it actually wasn't their milk stout I saw first. It was the Belgian White Nitro, which I had at Jack Brown's. But they bottle several of their offerings. I think they even have like an amber ale. The Sawtooth ale was one of their offerings that they bottled. And that was you know, kind of their first step away from initially trying the milk stout in, I think, like 2011. That was successful. So then they started bottling other nitros like the Sawtooth Amber Ale. And I think the other one was another stout. But yeah, so interesting technology. Also, if you have ever seen a tap handle at a brewery where they have like that special nitro handle, mm-hmm. So that uses a restrictor plate that kind of, when it comes through, the beer is forced through really kind of like a fine number of holes. And that in itself is kind of what creates the that cascade effect out of there. And it pours a little slower, you'll notice, like, than a lot of other like normal taps. And so a lot of times if you're getting a Guinness pour, like a nitro pour, it might take them several minutes if they're pouring it correctly.
Yeah.
Or if the carbonation is correct. It just comes out at a much slower pace because it's kind of, I mean, in the name restrictor plate, it kind of inherently tells you, like, it's coming through with a little bit of resistance. And so,
yeah. And well, restrictor plate's like the opposite of what you would want in a CO2 beer, because you're trying to not have too much resistance. And that's why when you're pouring from a regular tap, you want to open the handle all the way. Otherwise, right. You'll get excess mm-hmm. foaming and you'll cause a huge disturbance in the beer. So you have to use a little bit lower pressure because it's so easily soluble and there's just so much gas in the beer. But with the nitro, you know, you can really crank the pressure up. What were you saying the pressures sit at?
Yeah, so the recommended metrics from beerandbrewing.com, when you've got your system, if you've got a system already outfitted for your CO2, if you put on the nitro tap handle with that restrictor plate, it's going to provide that resistance that you need, and you bring the PSI up to a range of 30 to 35 PSI, which is quite a bit higher. You were saying, like, normally you do about 12 PSI for your home brews. So that's just a big jump in pressure, but with that resistance from the nitro tap handle and it's having that resistor plate, that gives you that slower pour, but it's kind of coming. It's a very similar thing to, like, again, we're kind of using a lot of espresso comparisons, but it's the same way where you're like forcing, you're putting a lot of pressure through something that has like a lot of resistance. And so it leaves you with, you know, you're getting a lot of gas out of it, but it's not in the form of, like, you know, gas we think of as like a crisp CO2. It's more of just a smooth crema. And that's why, like, espresso has that iconic look too, is because, you know, the gas from the coffee beans, when you're forcing that much pressure, which are then again is only like 9 bars of pressure for espresso, but like an immense amount of pressure with a lot of resistance, the result is that kind of
micro bubble.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's really compact, but very different processes between that and the widgets, and then of course this kind of halfway secret bottling technology they have. People on a lot of homebrew Reddit and like Reddit threads were talking about, you know, trying to do this at home, and it seems like it's like inconsistent results because they've tried a few things and it may work one time kind of okay, and other times not as well. And so to get it consistently, they must have done something at Left Hand where, I mean, they got it down just right to where they can repeat those results every time. I don't know if it's like the certain order they add in the liquid nitrogen or how much nitrogen is actually in the beer in solution, but it's a interesting thing. But like we said, we tried them side by side, the bottle and the can. Definitely a little bit of a difference. Like, it is noticeable, I think, having them side by side. If I hadn't done a head-to-head comparison, I'm not sure I would have been
noticed
that harsh on
difference.
Them.
Yeah.
But
definitely. It's just a lot different. I mean, it's a pretty different experience. So, and I'm curious, it'd be nice if we could get one on draft too, and then really have the full experience.
I know.
To see how they are. But
I thought about that and I was like, can I get a draft nitro here for recording and it still be like in a good state? And the nice thing with like nitro too is, you know, while it, yes, can quote unquote go flat, it's already at a state where it's not carbonated to be like, you know, vibrant and prickly and kind of effervescent. It's more meant to be already kind of smooth and mellow and creamy. And so it's a little more sustainable that way too, in that regard. But yeah, and just, you know, another thing, if you really are curious about Left Hand Brewing, I found a lot of cool information on their website. They talk about, you know, their history as a brewery, you know, them working with Ball Corporation to sort of patent and release the first U.S. produced and craft beer produced widget. It's called the widget inside. It's actually a different type of device than the little ball that we see in like Guinness, for example. And it's adhered to the bottom of the can, and it works the same, but it's a different, it's kind of more of like a inverted cup shape to me is what it looks like. It's not a ball. It's stuck to the bottom of the can. It's got the openings for the beer and the gas to enter once they've, you know, filled it with the beer, added the liquid nitrogen right on top, and then they close it right away to keep any of that from evaporating right away. Then they invert the can, and so now that widget that's at the bottom is at the headspace of the beer, and so that allows all of the allows that pressure to kind of force a little bit of that beer, a little bit of the gas into that chamber, and then of course when you crack it, you get that same effect. It's just, I don't know. I was kind of wondering, like, you know, why would they reinvent the wheel if something already worked? But, you know, the nice thing is that you don't have a little ball that you've got to, you know, worry about. Or I guess they're both, because I am curious if, like, the widget inside the Guinness can is recyclable, or if you have to cut it out or
whatever.
Yeah. Never really thought about that, but
I've not either.
Because it's plastic, and it's like, I don't know if it's like a recyclable plastic, so.
Yeah.
Versus, like, you know, if you put in a recyclable material in, as your widget, then you kind of make it a little easier, but.
Yeah.
But, yeah, definitely check out Left Hand. They're, like, about us and their Nitro history. Dating back to 2011, they have that bottling epiphany, I guess, if you will. And then they have, in 2017, their history about the Nitro widget inside that they developed for their milk stout. But and also a little fun fact. Nitrogen is created in the fusion of stars. So if you're drinking milk stout, nitro.
Drinking a little star juice.
Drinking a little star juice.
Star.
But,
but well, yeah.
I don't know. Star juice.
Well, yeah, we've got no LC tonight. So what do you say in lieu of LC pick of the week, we LC crack of that beer that we got left that goes along with our nitro theme?
I thought you'd never ask. This actually is a pretty good treat I've had before. This is the Belgian white we've talked about a couple times. And I thought it'd just be interesting to try, you know, something a little out of the ordinary for the nitro beer style.
Much different looking beer, obviously.
Yeah. One noticeable thing is, besides it being, you know, obviously much lighter because it's a wheat ale and not a stout, but the sort of effect of the nitro kind of cascade, not as present. I think it's just because it's light, so it's hard to see that contrast of, like, you know, the white bubbles don't really have the same look that, like, tan does against a very dark, almost black background. So,
yeah, and this has got some nice particulate matter floating, a nice unfiltered wheat.
Yep.
Smells very wheat beery on the schnoz.
And it's Belgian-y, so you get a little bit of that kind of, like, spice and, you know, get some phenols and some, like, zestiness to it. Like, really, I'm getting a ton of, like, spice character on the nose. That yeast is just so iconic.
You know, and it's interesting, given the taste, it's like you get that phenolic, spicy kind of warmth, but then smooth, you know. It's interesting. It's kind of like Christmassy.
Yeah, actually, no, that's a good analogy there. It is like a Christmassy type,
like
vibe.
A warm, spicy, not warm temperature wise, but like warmth, smooth. It's nice.
And the other thing is, I think you really get a much more elevated, like, flavor coming through, or like the flavors are a little more elevated by them not being kind of behind a wall of crisp carbonation.
Your tongue's not being assaulted by acidic CO2.
Yeah.
Bright pangs of carbonation.
Yeah, and there's something to that, I guess, you know, with certain styles kind of benefiting from carbonation as far as like CO2 versus some can be aided by not having CO2. but having some other kind of, you know, gas kind of lifting them. And so what I should have done is brought one of these and then just brought like a normal CO2 Belgian wheat just to see kind of
taste difference.
But based on memory alone, I mean, I've had several Belgian wheat beers.
It's funny because at first it almost like tastes flat, but then
I just feel like it's like a little more fragrant too, because sometimes like Belgian beers can be just really one dimensional for me. Like the bouquet is just like, you know, I get a little bit of yeast character, but it's just kind of like, I don't know, like banana-y sometimes.
That's bananas.
But yeah, I really do like this one. I haven't had it in a little bit, but yeah. I do remember I saw it and I was like, I want to get that. I just want to try a nitro wheat ale. And it works. Really smooth.
It does.
Really nice, silky mouthfeel. You get tons of, you know, phenolic character, tons of estery character. And, yeah, I mean, not a lot of fluff.
No, I like it. Great pick, Elsie.
She would have wanted us to have this.
Yeah, she would have. Rest in peace.
Pour this out for Elsie.
Florida. Oh, man. But yeah, if you want to drink more nitro beers, then go buy one and drink it. I don't know what to tell you. Like, I didn't think you needed me to tell you that, but come on. But yeah, get yourself a nitro beer. If you haven't had one in a while, revisit the little treat.
And then give yourself a nitro beer mustache.
Exactly. Maybe make a nitro beer float. Take a left-hand milk stout, get some vanilla ice cream, pour it on top, enjoy.
Thank us later.
Thank us later. I've never tried it, but I can imagine it's pretty good.
If you hate it, it wasn't our idea.
You came up with that terrible idea on your own. But yeah, if you want to learn more, check out that Hop Culture article about the history of nitro. They had a pretty good explanation of a few things. Check out Left Hand's site, not sponsored.
if only.
Yeah, and then, you know, like we said, grab a couple of bottles and enjoy them. What'd you learn today, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, really, I learned there is a difference in, you know, the mouthfeel between the canned nitro and the bottled nitro. That was an experiment that I've wondered about for a while, because like I said, I've had them separately, but never close enough in succession where I would be able to tell if there really was a difference. But you notice a little bit of a boost in actual like kind of crisp carbonation with the bottle, I felt like, and the flavor does get impacted by that a little bit, just to show how much CO2 actually does change the beer, not just by mouthfeel but by flavor. So you know, having different carbonation does have a bigger impact than just how it feels in the mouth.
Yeah, I learned that widgets aren't just for phones. But no, also I think the mind-blowing fact of the podcast to me was that, you know, cracking the beer does not crack the widget.
Mm-hmm.
That the widget is just hanging out there, just a little piece of plastic with some holes in it,
just waiting to soak up some of that gas and that beer and ready to release it to the world.
Mm-hmm. Soaking up gas and beer. Just like me.
It's like me every other night.
Putting out gas. Sucking up beer.
Whenever I open a beer, I release gas.
Did you just open a nitro beer? No, I didn't. What? Oh, man. But yeah, so that was episode number 86, talking about nitro beer. If you enjoyed it, make sure to give us a rating on your favorite podcast platform. Interact with us on our socials, on Instagram at East Carolina Beer. Just kidding, it's secondary fermentation. On Instagram, Facebook, East Carolina Beer and Brewing. Check out our website, eastcarolinabeer.com. And if you want to send us an email or just have a good old conversation with us, you can send us a message at eastcarolinabeer@gmail.com. See you in the next episode. Cheers.
Cheers.
Gee Willikers!